This is the WGBH Forum Network.
The book that's for sale this evening, This Mighty Scourge, is a book of essays that range over a variety of topics from the causes of the war, Confederate leadership and strategy, Union leadership and strategy, the memory of the war, Lincoln, a couple of essays on Lincoln. And it's really hard to construct a lecture that would synopsize that range of topics. So what I decided to do was to offer a lecture that intersects, at least in part, with one of the essays in the book. And the title of that essay in the book is No Peace Without Victory. But the lecture I'm going to give you this evening has a somewhat different slant and perspective on that same topic. And I'm going to start by talking a little bit about Civil War music, which may seem an odd way to start a lecture like this, but I hope the reason for doing so will become clear pretty soon. In the 19th century, music was an essential part of American culture in which nearly everybody got involved, not merely as listeners, but as participants. Hymn singing in church and at camp meeting revivals caught up a large part of the population. People sang at work and play as well as in church. Many middle-class families owned a piano or at least a fiddle or a harmonica. Publication of sheet music was a big business. People were fond of gathering in the parlor of an evening to sing popular songs and sentimental ballads. Popular music both expressed and reflected important themes in society and culture. People gave vent to their innermost feelings in song. And the Civil War brought even greater prosperity to music publishers. Soldiers in both North and South carried pocket songsters, as they were called, with the words to many songs, both old and new, for singing around the campfire to tunes that everybody knew so well that they didn't actually have to publish the music, just the words. Old songs, especially sentimental ones, were popular in both the Union and the Confederacy and expressed the universal longing of soldiers and their families. Such old songs, old even in 1860, as The Girl I Left Behind Me, Lorena, Ora Lee, and that all-time favorite on both sides, Home Sweet Home. But there were a lot of new songs written specifically for the war, and they too were often shared across the lines. For example, All Quiet Along the Potomac, a northern song originally, but almost equally popular in the South. Just Before the Battle, Mother. Or even Dixie, which had been written by a northerner as a minstrel song before the war and was popular among Union soldiers in the early months of the war before it became a southern anthem. In the first 2 years or so of the war, many of the popular songs that were written for the war or just came to light during the war were enthusiastic patriotic marches. The Bonnie Blue Flag in the Confederacy, the Yellow Rose of Texas, and of course Dixie. On the Union side, the Battle Hymn of the Republic, or in its more vernacular and I think probably popular form, John Brown's Body. Battle Cry of Freedom, which with slightly different words became popular in the South as well, and When Johnny Comes Marching Home, which was a northern song but equally popular in the South. These songs expressed confidence and a cheerful bearing of burdens and risks of a war that was sure to end in victory for one's own side. Many of these songs remained popular throughout the war. Some of them have remained popular down to this day. But by 1863, and especially in that terrible year of 1864, the mood of the new songs being sung began to darken, to become expressive of a growing weariness with the war, a longing for peace, a desire for an end to the suffering and the killing. In contrast to the upbeat rhythm and words of most songs in the first half of the war, the music and words of many in the second half of the war were downbeat, almost funereal. By all odds, the most widely sung ballad in the last half of the war was "When This Cruel War Is Over." Sometimes also known by the first words of its refrain, "Weeping, Sad and Lonely." This song was written by a Yankee in 1863 and first published in the North, but as like many sentimental songs, it became equally popular in the South with slight change in words, especially in the last year of the war, and it sold 1 million copies in sheet music. An enormous total at the time. Now, maybe that doesn't sound so enormous, but this was in a country, including both Union and Confederacy, of about 32 million people. Today, our population is over 300 million people, so it would correspond to 10 million copies of a single being sold today. By the summer of 1864, nearly 500,000 men had died in the war. Almost every family, especially in the South, had lost a relative or a friend. So the words of "When This Cruel War Is Over" seem to express the pain of these losses. And here are a couple of part of one of the verses in the song. "Oft in dreams I see thee lying on the battle plain, lonely, wounded, even dying, calling, but in vain." And this was far from the only song to express such sentiments in the last year or two of the war. The titles of several others, again, originally written and sung in the North, but soon making their way across the lines, the titles of these songs will make the point better than I can in any exposition of it. And here are some of those titles. "Who Will Care for Mother Now?" "Brother, Will You Come Back?" "Tell Me, Is My Father Coming Back?" "Mother, I Have Come Home to Die." Obviously, the heady optimism of 1861, the expectations on both sides for a short war and a glorious victory, had been replaced by a mood that bordered almost on despair and a desperate desire for the killing and this cruel war to be over. But how? How could the killing be brought to an end? How could peace be accomplished? There was the rub. Americans of the Civil War generation were far from the only people to discover that it is far more difficult to end a war than to start one. European nations relearned that lesson in the war of 1914 to 1918. Americans bitterly rediscovered it in the Vietnam War, and we've been forced to learn it all over again now in Iraq. Now, in what we call a limited war, where the goal is the defense or conquest of territory, a negotiated peace after that goal has been achieved by the victorious side may not be so difficult. And many Americans alive in the 1860s had been through wars in which that they had been concluded by peace negotiations and by a treaty, the War of 1812 and the Mexican War. But in an all-out war where the very survival of one or both nations, governments, or societies is at stake, a negotiated peace sometimes seems impossible. And that was the case in the American Civil War, where the issues of national sovereignty and eventually slavery or freedom were, in effect, non-negotiable. By 1863, the year of the song, "When This Cruel War Is Over," three different positions had emerged in both North and South about how to bring an end to this cruel war. The first was the official policy of both the Union and Confederate governments under Abraham Lincoln and Jefferson Davis. Peace could be achieved only by victory. For Lincoln, victory meant the surrender of Confederate armies, the dissolution of the Confederate government, and the return of the Southern states to the Union. By 1863, it had also come to mean emancipation of the slaves. For Davis, victory meant Confederate independence as a sovereign nation, which, in his view, could be accomplished either by formal negotiations between a sovereign United States and a sovereign Confederate States, or merely by the North giving up trying to conquer the South and by withdrawing its troops from the Confederacy. As you can see, these official war aims on each side were mutually exclusive. No compromise was possible so long as both sides defined victory in these ways. In effect, Lincoln's policy was unconditional surrender by the Confederacy. Davis's policy was unconditional recognition of the Confederate independence by the United States. By 1863, these uncompromisable positions seemed to give little promise that this cruel war would ever be over. A second position, held by several prominent people on both sides, was the advocacy of a ceasefire, or armistice, followed by negotiations based on certain prior conditions agreed to by both sides. In the North, this position was associated with what were called war Democrats. That is, they didn't support the Lincoln administration, but they did support the war. Like George B. McClellan, who ran for president against Lincoln in 1864, pledging negotiations to end the war if the Confederacy agreed in advance to reunion as a condition for such negotiations. All other issues, McClellan said, were negotiable, including slavery. In the South, this position was associated most prominently with a pair of your fellow Georgians, Governor Joseph Brown and Confederate Vice President Alexander H. Stephens. They proposed that after military victories, the Confederacy should offer to come to the negotiating table during an armistice to work out a lasting peace. If the Lincoln administration accepted such an offer, this acceptance would constitute de facto recognition of the Confederacy as an equal power, and therefore an implicit recognition of Confederate independence. If the negotiations broke down and failed, Stephens and Brown believed that the North would not have the will to start fighting again. And Stephens was actually involved in the summer of 1863 in an abortive effort to do precisely that. At the same time that Robert E. Lee's Army of Northern Virginia was invading Pennsylvania in a campaign that culminated at Gettysburg, Stephens traveled down the James River to Union lines under a flag of truce at Fortress Monroe and sent a message to Washington requesting to be allowed to cross the lines and come to Washington to carry on negotiations ostensibly about restarting or dealing with some problems with the prisoner of war exchange cartel. But what Stephens really intended to do was to arrive in Washington after Lee had won a major victory in his invasion of Pennsylvania with the hope that might force the Lincoln administration to negotiate peace. Of course, when the news of Gettysburg reached Washington, Lincoln sent word that he didn't want to see Stephens. Now, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to see that this second position, that is, negotiations based on prior conditions agreed to by both sides, had little promise for peace so long as Lincoln and Davis remained at the head of their respective governments. Lincoln had made it clear many times that he would not recognize an independent Confederacy explicitly or implicitly. Davis had made it equally clear that he would agree to no prior condition of reunion. At one time or another, as we'll see, both Lincoln and Davis said they were willing to negotiate to end the war, but only if the other side would accept his prior conditions. But each president knew that his adversary would not accept such conditions, and therefore a negotiated peace in that context was clearly impossible. So what's left? The third position on how to end this cruel war was the advocacy of a ceasefire and negotiations without any prior conditions. Stop fighting, come to the negotiating table, work it out there. That was the position of the Peace Democrats, or the so-called Copperheads in the North, and of their counterparts in the South, sometimes called Tories or Reconstructionists. That is, they favored Reconstruction of the Union, were alleged to. In effect, these people came close to embracing the cause of peace at any price, even at the price of defeat. On both sides, not surprisingly, this peace faction grew stronger when the war was going badly for their own side and victory seemed impossible, or at least impossibly distant and no longer worth the cost in lives and resources. Advocates of this position argued that if peace through victory was impossible, and as the war dragged on, that became more and more what many people thought, and if negotiations with prior conditions were unacceptable to the other side, then the only alternative left was to stop fighting and go to the negotiating table without any prior conditions. Now, in both North and South, these advocates of this peace negotiating position insisted that their national goals could be achieved through such negotiations. Peace Democrats in the North, like Clement Vallandigham of Ohio, who was the foremost copperhead, said that negotiations would be the first step toward a brotherly reunion of North and South in one nation. The first step. It might take years, but you have to start somewhere, he said. And the war was not the way to do it. And peacemen in the South, like William W. Holden of North Carolina, editor of the Raleigh Standard, the largest newspaper in the state, said that negotiations would be the first step toward recognition of Southern rights and sovereignty, whatever that meant, and he didn't want to explain too clearly what he thought it meant. The devil would, of course, be in the details. But, of course, both could not be right. Both Vallandigham saying it would be the first step toward reunion, Holden saying it would recognize Southern sovereignty, both could not be right. And any request by one side for an armistice when things were going badly for that side would in effect be a confession of defeat. An offer to stop fighting in the hope of salvaging a little bit of dignity to prevent further destruction and defeat. That, indeed, was the case with Germany when it requested an armistice in 1918. It was a confession that Germany had lost the war. In the American Civil War, most people on both sides recognized that for one side to request an armistice and negotiations without prior conditions would likewise be an acknowledgement of defeat or imminent defeat. Thus, the peace Democrats in the North and the peacemen in the South were branded by the majority in each section as traitors to their own side, to their cause. Okay, to summarize thus far, there was a kind of catch-22 about, about the whole notion of a negotiated peace in the Civil War. An armistice with prior conditions was impossible because the other side would not agree to such conditions. An armistice without prior conditions amounted to a surrender because the side requesting it was, in effect, admitting defeat. And to illustrate these problems, let's take a look at the fate of various peace initiatives in 1864 and 1865, and the first one is very close to home here in Georgia. The second half of 1863 was a bad time for the Confederacy. Gettysburg, Vicksburg, Chattanooga, the loss of much of Arkansas, on and on. And in that context, in early 1864, both Governor Brown, Joe Brown, and Vice President Stevens, while remaining dedicated to the goal of Confederate independence, started talking about trying to negotiate an end of the war. Both of them had, and this is putting it mildly, an intense dislike or contempt for Jefferson Davis. And they both allowed their dislike to betray them into an opposition to his war policies that looked to many observers like a commitment to peace at any price. Brown presented peace resolutions to the Georgia legislature in early 1864, and Stevens came down to Macon, to Milledgeville, where the capital was then, and supported them in a three-hour speech to the legislature that focused entirely on peace and buried any qualifications in so deeply in the rhetoric that it looked like he was calling for peace at any price, even the price of defeat. If you look carefully at that speech, Stevens was advocating that the Confederates offer to negotiate only after Southern victories, which he hoped would come in 1864 on the battlefield, and only with Confederate independence as a precondition for negotiations. Brown's and Stevens's intent was to divide Northern opinion and strengthen the peace Democrats in the 1864 Northern presidential and congressional elections by appearing to offer negotiations. on terms contained in the small print, buried, that they knew Lincoln would reject. But this subtlety escaped most true blue Confederate Southerners who missed the small print and regarded Brown and Stevens as renegades. Instead of dividing and conquering the North, their peace gambit seemed likely to play into the hands of Yankees hoping to divide and conquer the South. Senator Herschel Johnson of Georgia told Stevens, "You are wrong in view of your official position. You are wrong because the whole movement originated in a mad purpose to make war on Jefferson Davis and Congress. You are wrong because the movement is joyous to the enemy and they are already using it in their press." Well, the Georgia legislature got that message and hastily passed a resolution pledging Georgia's continuing support for the war, and Brown and Stevens backed off. But far more important were other peace overtures during the summer of 1864. And to set up the context for that, we need to take a look at the military situation in May of 1864, when General Grant, who was now General-in-Chief of all the United States armies, traveling with the Army of the Potomac, and General Sherman launched their dual campaigns in Virginia and Georgia in May 1864. Many people in the North, probably most people in the North, hoped and expected that these heavy hitters, Grant and Sherman, would win the war by the 4th of July. Instead, by that date, Union armies were bogged down in apparent stalemate after suffering 90,000 casualties in the most concentrated carnage of the war so far. On July 12th, an editorial in the New York newspaper asked plaintively, "Who shall revive the withered hopes that bloomed at the opening of Grant's campaign?" Confederate military strategy in 1864 was to fight on the defensive from elaborate entrenchments and to force the enemy to waste his manpower attacking these fortified defenses. If the Confederates could hold out until the Union presidential election in 1864, and if they could inflict enough casualties on the attacking Yankees, they hoped to defeat Lincoln's reelection and then negotiate with Lincoln's Democratic successor for a peace that would recognize Confederate independence. And by July 1864, that strategy seemed to be working. Several northern newspapers would have banner headlines saying, "Stop the war." If nothing else would impress upon the people, this is a quotation, "If nothing else would impress upon the people the absolute necessity of stopping this war, its utter failure to accomplish any results would be sufficient." By August 1864, the veteran New York Republican Politico, Thurlow Weed, kind of the Karl Rove of his time, Thurlow Weed was convinced that the people are wild for peace. Lincoln's reelection is an impossibility. Well, in this context, in the summer of 1864, two separate and abortive peace efforts took place, both of them illustrating the impossibility of a negotiated peace so long as Lincoln and Davis stuck with their respective war aims and as long as they remained in office. The first effort was inaugurated by Horace Greeley, the quixotic editor of the New York Tribune, one of the North's most powerful Republican newspapers. Greeley wrote a letter to Lincoln in July. "Our bleeding, bankrupt, almost dying country longs for peace, shudders at the prospect of fresh conscriptions, of further wholesale devastations, and of new rivers of human blood." Greeley had learned that two Confederate envoys were at Niagara Falls, Canada, supposedly bearing peace proposals from Jefferson Davis. "I entreat you," Greeley wrote Lincoln, "to submit overtures for pacification to the Southern insurgents." Lincoln immediately responded, sent a telegram to Greeley authorizing him to bring to Washington under a pass of safe conduct, quote, "any person anywhere professing to have any proposition of Jefferson Davis in writing for peace, embracing the restoration of the Union and abandonment of slavery." Lincoln knew perfectly well that these Confederate agents were in Canada to stir up trouble and encourage anti-war activities in the North and not to negotiate peace. But Lincoln thought he saw an opportunity in this episode to show to the Northern people the hollowness of Southern professions of a desire for negotiations. He prodded Greeley to go to Niagara Falls to meet these supposed peace negotiators face to face. Greeley was reluctant, but he finally did so, accompanied by Lincoln's private secretary, John Hay, bearing Lincoln's terms for negotiations, reunion, and emancipation. But on this occasion, Lincoln's strategy boomeranged. The two Confederate agents, Clement Clay of Alabama, James Holcomb of Mississippi, turned this affair into a Confederate propaganda triumph by releasing a statement to the press accusing Lincoln of sabotaging the chances for peace by prescribing conditions he knew to be unacceptable to the South. And this press release is a wonderful example of a Victorian spin, if we can call it that, Victorian language, but modern-day spin. If there be any citizen of all the Confederate states who has clung to the hope that peace is possible, they said, Lincoln's draconian terms will strip from their eyes the last film of such delusion. And if there are any patriots or Christians in the North who shrink appalled from the illimitable vistas of private misery and public calamity presented by Lincoln's policy of what they called perpetual war, let them recall the abused authority and vindicate the outraged civilization of their country. In other words, vote Lincoln out of office. Well, Lincoln turned out to be the loser in this propaganda blitz. The Northern Democratic press blasted the president as the sole obstacle to peace. Even some Republican newspapers criticized Lincoln for appearing to be inflexible. Greeley scolded him for giving, as Greeley put it, to the general eye, the impression that the rebels are anxious to negotiate and that we repulse their advances. If nothing was done to correct this impression, Greeley said, we shall be beaten out of sight next November in the elections. But then Jefferson Davis did something to neutralize this Southern propaganda victory by his response to an almost simultaneous, though less publicized, peace overture. This one was initiated by a more obscure Northern journalist than Greeley, a man named James Gilmore, and by the colonel of the 71st Illinois, James Jacques, who was also happened to be a Methodist clergyman, with a good war record, but someone who wanted to bring an end to Christians slaughtering each other. They persuaded Lincoln to give them a pass through Union lines in Virginia for an unofficial effort to see Jefferson Davis, and they actually persuaded Davis to receive them. Lincoln again hoped that this unofficial contact would smoke out Davis's insistence on Confederate independence as a prior condition for any negotiations, and thereby convince the North that this is a lose-lose type proposition. This time it worked, sort of. In a meeting between the two Northern envoys on one side and Davis and his Secretary of State Judah Benjamin on the other in Richmond, Davis expressed defiance toward Lincoln's willingness to negotiate on the basis of union and freedom. We are fighting for independence, Davis declared defiantly, according to Gilmore's account of the discussion. We are fighting for independence, and that or extermination we will have. You may emancipate every Negro in the Confederacy, but we will be free. We will govern ourselves if we have to see every Southern plantation sacked and every Southern city in flames. Well, after all of the publicity about these two abortive peace overtures, and believe me, it got massive publicity in the newspapers, no one could doubt that Davis's irreducible condition of peace was disunion, while Lincoln's was reunion. That served Lincoln's purpose of discrediting Copperhead notions of peace and reunion through negotiations. As Lincoln later put it in a message to Congress, Davis does not attempt to deceive us. He affords us no excuse to deceive ourselves. He cannot voluntarily reaccept the Union. We cannot voluntarily yield it. Between him and us, the issue is distinct, simple, and inflexible. It is an issue which can only be tried by war and decided by victory. But at the rock bottom point in northern Morrell in August 1864, when, as Thurlow Weed put it, the people are wild for peace, Northern Democratic newspapers were able to slide around the awkward problem of Davis's conditions by pointing to Lincoln's second condition, emancipation, as the real stumbling block to peace. As a typical Democratic editorial put it, tens of thousands of white men must yet bite the dust to allay the Negro mania of the president. Even some Republicans criticized what they described as Lincoln's blunder in making emancipation one of his conditions, because it enabled the opposition to fasten on that issue and to ignore Davis's insistence on disunion. Henry J. Raymond, who wore two hats in 1864, he was editor of the New York Times, but he was also chairman of the Republican National Committee in Lincoln's reelection campaign. Raymond told Lincoln on August 22nd that if the presidential election were to be held then, the Republicans would lose big. Raymond said, two special causes are assigned for this great reaction in public sentiment. First, the want of military success. And second, the impression that we can have peace with Union if we would, but that you are fighting not for Union, but for the abolition of slavery. Lincoln came under enormous pressure, as a consequence, to drop emancipation as a prior condition. To do so would highlight Davis's insistence on disunion so clearly that nobody could miss it. It would clarify and simplify the issue. The Republican National Committee urged Lincoln, as they put it, to make distinct proffers of peace to Davis on the sole condition of union, all other questions to be settled in the convention of the people of all the states. Of course, they quickly went on to say, they expected Davis to reject the proffer, which, of course, is what they wanted, because it would, quote, dispel all the delusions about peace that prevail in the North and reconcile public sentiment to the war, the draft, and the tax as inevitable necessities. Lincoln almost succumbed to this pressure. He drafted a letter to a Northern Democrat that included this sentence: if Jefferson Davis wishes to know what I would do if he were to offer peace and reunion, saying nothing about slavery, let him try me. And Lincoln also drafted instructions to Henry Raymond to go as an official this time, envoy to Richmond, and propose as Lincoln's representative that upon the restoration of the Union and the national authority, the war shall cease at once, all remaining questions to be left for adjustment by peaceful modes. But having gone this far, Lincoln suddenly pulled back. He did not send that "Let Jefferson Davis try me" letter. And he canceled Raymond's mission to Richmond. Why? Lincoln was convinced that to back off publicly, with all of the publicity that this would have, to back off publicly from emancipation as a condition, even as a ploy to smoke out Davis, would be seen as a betrayal of the freed slaves who had worked and fought for the Union. Lincoln told weak-kneed Republicans, no human power can subdue this rebellion without using the emancipation lever as I have done. He pointed out that more than 100,000 black soldiers and sailors were at that moment fighting for the Union. If they stake their lives for us, Lincoln said, they must be prompted by the strongest motive, the promise of freedom. And the promise being made must be kept. Why should they give their lives for us with full notice of our purpose to betray them? I should be damned in time and in eternity for so doing. The world shall know that I will keep my faith to friends and enemies, come what will. When Lincoln wrote those words, he and everyone else fully expected him to lose his bid for reelection. Just a few days after Lincoln wrote these words, the Democratic National Convention nominated General McClellan for president on a platform that declared, after 4 years of failure to restore the Union by the experiment of war, we demand that immediate efforts be made for a cessation of hostilities with a view to an ultimate convention of the states or other peaceable means to the end that at the earliest practicable moment, peace may be restored on the basis of the Federal Union. That last phrase was mere window dressing. Everyone realized that any such cessation of hostilities without prior agreement on reunion would be tantamount to Confederate victory and independence. And that earliest practicable moment for reunion probably would come maybe in the 22nd century. That's why McClellan, in his letter accepting the nomination, made union a prior condition for any ceasefire. In other words, he didn't accept a key part of the platform. But this whole question suddenly became moot because of what happened here. 2 days after McClellan's nomination, a telegram arrived in Washington from General Sherman. Atlanta is ours and fairly won. It would be impossible to exaggerate the impact of that news. It turned morale around in both North and South by 180 degrees. It appeared to be the breakthrough that would be the beginning of the end, a victorious end for the North. The famous New York diarist and lawyer, George Templeton Strong, wrote in his diary on September 3rd, "Glorious news! Atlanta taken at last!" 3 exclamation points. "It is, coming at this political crisis, the greatest event of the war." The Richmond Examiner reflected glumly that the disaster at Atlanta came in the very nick of time to save the party of Lincoln from irretrievable ruin. "It will diffuse gloom over the South." Indeed, it did. Mary Boykin Chesnut, the South's most famous diarist, wrote, "Since Atlanta, I have felt as if all were dead within me forever. We are going to be wiped off the earth." And things only got worse for the Confederacy in the next few months. Victories by Union General Philip Sheridan's Army of the Shenandoah all but destroyed Jubal Early's corps, once commanded by Stonewall Jackson. Lincoln was triumphantly reelected on a platform calling for unconditional surrender of the Confederacy and a 13th Amendment to the Constitution to abolish slavery forever and everywhere. Sherman set out on his destructive march through Georgia. At the Battle of Nashville in December, Union General George Thomas's army virtually wiped out the Army of Tennessee, the Confederacy's second largest army. In January 1865, a Union task force captured Fort Fisher in North Carolina, closing off the port of Wilmington, which had been the last port into which blockade runners could bring supplies. The Confederacy's days seemed numbered. And in this context of events, one more effort for negotiated peace flared up and then fizzled up. This time it was the old Jacksonian Democrat, Francis Preston Blair, of Maryland, an old friend of Jefferson Davis's, but somebody who had become a Republican along with the rest of the Blair family in the middle 1850s. It was Blair who set up a meeting between Lincoln and his Secretary of State, William H. Seward, on one side, and 3 Confederates, led by Vice President Alexander Stevens, on the other. They met in early February 1865 on the Union steamer River Queen, which had become a sort of presidential yacht for Lincoln, at Hampton Roads, where the James River empties into the Chesapeake Bay. The meeting was cordial and, at least at first, relaxed. Lincoln and Stevens had been friends and fellow Whigs back in the 1840s when they served together in Congress. Stevens has emerged in this talk before. He was a fascinating figure. He probably had more brains and less brawn than anyone in the South. He weighed only 95 pounds. He was so pasty-faced that an irreverent Confederate soldier who saw him once said that he had been dead for several days but didn't know it yet. Stevens was in the habit of wearing a thick, heavy, floor-length fur coat, even in mild weather. And he was wearing that when he got on the River Queen. And when he wriggled his way out of this coat for the meeting with Lincoln and Seward, Lincoln remarked that he had never seen such a small ear of corn come out of such a large husk. Stavins took this ribbing in good style. Everybody relaxed. But if the Confederate commissioners thought that Lincoln's hospitality and the relaxed atmosphere meant easy peace terms, they were in for a rude surprise. No real negotiations would be possible, said Lincoln, until all Confederate soldiers laid down their arms. When one of the Southern commissioners responded that during the English Civil War of the 1640s, even King Charles I had negotiated with rebels in arms, Lincoln responded with a wry smile, "I do not profess to be posted in history. All I distinctly recollect about the case of Charles I is he lost his head." In any case, said Lincoln, his terms were the same as they had been the previous summer, reunion and emancipation. The Southerners professed shock, but such professions were disingenuous. Lincoln had never given them any reason to expect otherwise. After all, at the low point in Northern morale the previous summer, he had insisted on these terms, and there was certainly no reason to make them any softer now, with Union forces victorious everywhere. Jefferson Davis was delighted with the failure of the Hampton Roads Conference. It was just what he expected and, in fact, just what he wanted, because he could use it to whip up Southern enthusiasm for continuing the war. Davis went before a mass meeting in Richmond to rally his people to fight on to avoid what he called such a degrading submission and humiliating surrender, as Lincoln's terms demanded. In a fiery speech, Davis predicted that Confederate armies would yet, as he put it, compel the Yankees in less than 12 months to petition us for peace on our terms. I don't know whether Davis really believed in that fantasy. In any event, Southerners should have paid more attention to Lincoln's words in his annual message to Congress back in December 1864, is what we today call the State of the Union message, after Lincoln's reelection. The Northern people, Lincoln said, were never more determined to win the war than now. And the resources to do the job, he went on to say, are unexhausted and, as we believe, inexhaustible. Material resources are now more complete and abundant than ever. We are gaining strength and may, if need be, maintain the contest indefinitely. Fortunately, the war did not go on indefinitely. 4 months later came Appomattox. The war did not end with a negotiated peace. Given the non-negotiable war aims of each side, it could not have done so. It ended with the surrender of Confederate armies and the extinction of both slavery and the Confederate States of America. Well, I'll be glad to try to answer your questions.
Gray heads of people who are natives to here. As a boy, we saw the Confederate home out in Chastain Park and still had Confederate veterans there, and we heard from our fathers and our grandfathers a tale of the Civil War that's not in modern historical writings, that Lincoln was a racist and the Emancipation Proclamation was for Southern states occupied by the Confederacy only, that he was a lobbyist for the railroads and for the canals, and that he was a anti-states rights person, and that the people in the South believed in the constitutional construction, that the states were more important than the rest. Now, in the last two decades, we've seen all of these books, Lincoln Unmasked, and we've seen Webb, and all these other books that are making you look at Lincoln like our own Stalin, who was here to create this this great utopian society that diminished independent rights. I mean, you're very well written, and I've read a lot of your stuff. I'd like to know how you view this new wave of writing and this new way of looking at Lincoln and the way this war turned out, particularly since probably 90% of the people in here weren't born and raised down in this part of the country, didn't listen to their daddies and their granddaddies talk about it.
I'm quite familiar with the historiography you're talking about. And I think it comes from two principal sources, which are overlapping. One are libertarians who blame Lincoln more than almost any other president. Maybe Franklin Delano Roosevelt would be in the same axis of evil for having created the Leviathan state, the centralized state power that they hate, the libertarians, having undermined and destroyed state sovereignty. That's one of the sources for this. And the other overlapping source, I think, is from organizations like the League of the South and other very sort of neo-Confederate right-wing sources. I think that's where most of this is coming from. But if you look at the total body of Lincoln scholarship and Civil War scholarship in the last two decades, which you've mentioned, it's overwhelmingly the other way, what we might call mainstream historiography, which includes most Southern historians who look at these issues, including Lincoln, although they're more likely to look at other kinds of things than Lincoln's leadership. They have very high regard for Lincoln, and for the most part see the results of the Civil War as having been progressive in terms of widening the role of the federal government to promote social welfare, to fulfill the preamble of the Constitution, to promote the welfare of the American people, and of course having also abolished slavery. So while you're right, there is that countervailing trend, I think it maybe affects maybe 5, at most 10% of people who are seriously interested in these questions. I think you are actually next, even though, yeah. Oh, yes. I think there's no question that he would have yielded the presidency. In fact, he wrote the famous blind memorandum. I didn't talk about that in the talk. I do to analyze it in the book. On the same day that he got that letter from Henry Raymond that I quoted in the lecture saying, you know, we're going to lose big, Lincoln wrote on one side of a piece of paper that today, this morning, as for some days past, it appears that this administration will not be reelected. It will therefore be our duty to cooperate with the president-elect to save the Union between the time of his election and his inauguration. And remember, in those days, there are 4 months. It's March 4th. Because he will have been elected on such grounds that it will be impossible for him to save the Union after that. Because it would have had a Democratic Congress, it would have been interpreted. But clearly, Lincoln's anticipating losing. And he's anticipating cooperating with the president-elect before the president-elect takes the inauguration. He then folded that paper and had every one of his cabinet members sign it sight on scene. And I've sometimes been asked, well, why sight on scene? What's the point? Well, I think he feared a leak. If he showed them what he had written, and one of them just let, you know, some hint of that come out, think of the enormous impact that would have had on public opinion. Here's the President of the United States and his cabinet anticipating losing. You don't make that public. So I think that's why it was the so-called blind memorandum. But that clearly is an indication that, A, Lincoln expected at that moment, at any rate, to lose, and B, he was going to cooperate with the president-elect, whom he anticipated would be McClellan. And then would, you know, ride off into the sunset, hoping that he had saved the Union before McClellan became president. Yeah.
In your book in 1996, Gone with the Sword, you wrote on page 193, wages in the scale of war, these 190,000 black soldiers and sailors, probably a larger number of black army laborers, tipped the balance in favor of Union victory. I agree with what you wrote there. I was wondering if 11 years later you still agree with what you said 11 years ago.
I do. I do agree with that. I think it did tip the balance. Because every one of those, or most of those 190,000 were former slaves. And most of the laborers who worked as teamsters, as cooks, as wood choppers, as, you know, any number of different things for the Union Army, were also former slaves. And many of those former slaves had, of course, contributed to the Confederate economy and war effort as workers, as laborers, as farmers. And now, so it takes one away from the Confederacy and adds one to the Union. That does tip the balance, I think. And Lincoln himself said that in the thing I quoted. You know, no person can win this war without using the emancipation lever as I have done, 100,000 or more than 100,000 at that moment, August 64, were fighting for the Union. We can't do without them. I think he was right, and I still agree with it, yeah.
In your chapter on Grant and Sherman, you say, if any general deserved the label butcher, it was Lee. A little further, you say, for the war as a whole, which seems like a qualification, Lee's army had a higher casualty rate than the armies commanded by Grant. Could you elaborate?
Yeah. Grady McQuinney and Perry Jameson did a book about 15, well, more than that now, called Attack and Die, in which they elaborately calculated the casualty rates under all of the principal army commanders in both the Union and Confederate armies. And Lee's armies commanded by Lee, the Army of Northern Virginia, had higher casualty rates than any other Civil War general. Grant was second. The example that I like to use to illustrate this, because I think it brings it home very starkly, is the contrast in the historical perception of Pickett's charge at Gettysburg and the Army of the Potomac's attack at Cold Harbor just exactly 11 months later on June 3rd, 1864. Pickett's charge at Gettysburg has been celebrated in song and story as an example of undaunted courage. And the Union attack at Cold Harbor under Grant's orders has been denigrated as bullheaded tactics of ramming your head against a stone wall. But stop and think for a moment. Pickett's charge involved 13,000 Confederate soldiers, of whom 6,000 to 7,000 did not come back, 50% casualties. Grant's attack at Cold Harbor involved 50,000 soldiers and 7,000 casualties, 14%. Yet we don't, you know, we see one as being an example of noble courage and the other of bullheaded stupidity. Why? I think it's because of the historical sort of images that have come down to us of Lee and Grant.
Poetry.
I'm sorry?
Poetry.
Poetry. Well, Southern poetry, okay. I think you were next, is that right? One of each? Okay, go ahead here.
I would agree with you after reading Alexander Porter's book, and he made the comment that the high point for the Confederacy was the Battle of the 7 Days around Richmond. I guess I agree with that example. Pickett's charge, I believe, was probably desperation. I agree with the recent article on the magazine that said that Lee felt he had to win something and get it. And obviously, he was fighting blind, and if you read any number of soldiers' accounts, they often say there were more Yankees than, you know, anybody had ever seen in the world at Gettysburg, and they didn't have a chance anyway. So, but the question I really had was in relation to Lincoln and the recent book about his problem with depression throughout his life. And I think that says more to the gentleman's comment there than anything. I wonder how you felt or feel that works into the comment you made about the blind memo and some other things, because I read that book and I thought, as knowing someone suffering something similar, that that was a big issue that he fought throughout his life, and I could see where during the war it would force him more to believe in what you're saying, that he would take the moment of these are great setbacks and I'm was even worse. I mean, he fought through it throughout his life, but I think it had a big impact, and I wonder how you felt.
Yes, I've read the book, Joshua Schenck's book, and I think it's a good one. He overstates his case, which is not surprising because he has personally suffered from depression And so there's an empathy there, and also a tendency to claim Lincoln as, you know, one of the same fraternity. But his argument there, as I read it, is that Lincoln fought through these bouts of depression, which were especially severe in his earlier life over relations with women primarily, without any of the psychiatric help of modern psychiatry and modern society, and that made him stronger in the end, that he was able to empathize with those who suffered, but he was also able to fight through his own depression in a way that enabled him to be stronger as he fought through it. And during the war, of course, he also had to deal with the problem of his wife's very serious depression after Willie died in February of 1862. So he had more than a single burden. He also felt, I think, every one of the 360,000, or for that matter, 260,000 Union soldiers, or that matter, 260,000 Confederate soldiers who died in this war. He visited hospitals, and so did Mary Lincoln, in Washington that included captured Confederate wounded, and he tried to comfort them just as much as he comforted wounded Union. And I think that he was able to achieve this kind of empathy because of what he had gone through himself. So I think that book, while I do believe it, you know, it's overstated and exaggerated, is nevertheless on the mark and worth reading. Well, we can never know for sure, but I think the second of the two options that you talked about is the more likely scenario. That is, McClellan's election would have been an enormous shot in the arm for Confederate morale. They would have seen it as a huge victory. And rather than back off and appear to agree with his prior conditions of union for negotiations, I think they would have said, you know, forget it, we can win this war. But that's just, you know, that's purely speculation. We can't know for sure.